Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Frogs of War radio show. I am Jamie, she is Melissa, and tonight we are joined by special guest, former TCU offensive lineman Jeff Olson. Jeff, how are you doing tonight, bud?
I'm good. How are y'all? Thanks for having me back.
Oh, man, it's been a while, but we're glad to have you back.
So there will be adventures ahead for sure. So this should be a good show. I mean, our Sunday night shows are getting pretty off the hook here. So this is
you know,
good.
Late night, it's Frogs of War after dark. Got the
Frogs
at home and the Frogs of War drinks game. So, Jeff, just so
Let's
you know,
hope,
I don't think you know the rules. The rules to the Frogs of War drinking game. Every time Melissa makes some sort of coach's cliche, take a drink.
Okay.
Anytime that I say the word definitely, take a drink. And by the end of this,
okay, sounds good.
We'll all get on Twitter and make fools of ourselves. So
I don't think we need the drinking game to do that, but
no, that's very fair. That's very fair. So y'all,
I'll go ahead and send my wife to the liquor store then.
Excellent. Obvious place to start the show tonight is with the game that happened yesterday in Fort Worth, yesterday morning. With TCU beating Iowa State 41-20. It was a good way to start off the Big 12 run for TCU with a good win over a team that's been kind of a bottom dweller, hasn't done much this season already, getting stomped by Iowa the week before they played the Frogs. And so, y'all, just quick hit right off the top. What do y'all make of this win over Iowa State?
I'll let you go ahead, Jeff. We'll guess first here.
All right, I appreciate it. Yeah, you know, I think it was a good win. You know, there's definitely a lot of things that could be learned, and you know, did a whole lot of good things, especially from an offensive perspective, and you know, defense kind of moving in that bend don't break sort of deal, and you know, they definitely held the that big time wide receiver for Iowa State going to be playing on Sundays, held him in check for the, you know, the majority of the game. But, you know, as Coach Williamson always said while I was there, you know, there wasn't any reason to cancel practice. So there was definitely a lot to learn from, and a lot that we can, you know, button up a little bit moving forward. But it's definitely a good way to start off conference play with a win after a downer against Arkansas. It was definitely a good way to get the guys some confidence moving into SMU next week, and then some more conference play after that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are some good things to take from this game. You know, liked what we saw from the defense, loved how they handled Lazard, who, you know, to this point had been absolutely dominant in the receiving game for Iowa State, but was held to just one catch for 8 yards against TCU. And with the mixed match of corners we threw out there, that was pretty impressive work by the Frog defense. What I really liked, and the two things that really stuck stood out to me where John Diarz was just dominant, just a really nice physical presence, showed soft hands, went up to get that couple balls, made some really nice conversions on third down. And the other thing, you know, Kyle Hicks was unbelievable, and I'm sure we'll spend some time talking to him, but sure was nice to see Travoris Johnson get in the game and make something happen. Four carries, 47 yards and a touchdown, looks like that second option we needed at running back that we have yet to see kind of develop. So, nice to see the run game get going. Nice to see Kenny Hill not asked to do too much Saturday morning. But I like the way things kind of got spread around a little bit. And we saw some guys get into action that hadn't really had a chance to make their mark on the season thus far.
Yeah, it was definitely one of those games that can be a confidence builder. But like you said, Jeff, there's a lot to work on still. Gary Patterson in his postgame press conference was more upset than I've seen him in a season or two. Just very frustrated, didn't like the way that the cornerbacks played, didn't like the way the defensive played on the whole, thought they gave up too many yards to Iowa State, said he thought that they should have really limited Iowa State's offense to 60 plays or less, which didn't happen, was frustrated with the tempo of the game, but at the same time commended his defense for getting lined up better than they did against Arkansas, despite the tempo being faster on Saturday than it was in week two. But all in all, I mean, you're at 2-1 now, right? And Patterson said it in his press conference, you got to get to 2 to get to 3. And so it's a win. And with the way that the Big 12 is shaking up, which we'll get to in a little bit, it's very much a wide open race to the top of the conference still. So, you know, y'all, I think that for the game that it was, as hot as it was outside, as, you know, maybe unmotivated as some of the guys were, it's a good win. It was a win by 3 touchdowns. So,
well, you know, that is the one thing that kind of sticks out to me as a concern is, as you kind of touched on both points there. Number one, the fact that Patterson's still talking about his guys being unmotivated. He said they were unmotivated going into Arkansas, which makes me think this wasn't just kind of a hangover effect from losing that game in double overtime. And the other thing that's concerning is that we're on the third game of the season, and he's praising his defense for getting lined up right. So still a lot of kinks to work out, still a really, really young group. But the biggest thing that we just want to see develop, and we talked about this on last week's show with Robert Henson, is where is the leadership? Who is that guy that's going to get in somebody's face and tell them it doesn't matter that it's 11 a.m., it doesn't matter that it's, you know, the heat index on the field is probably 120 degrees or more. This is a Big 12 conference game, and you got to go out there and do your job.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And you know, Henson really hit the nail on the head with that. There definitely needs to be that one guy leading both the units and the team as a whole, and just getting them ready to go. And it was tough. You know, I talking with, you know, the other guys that, you know, I still talk with, you know, saying it's probably going to be a little underwhelming, and, you know, could be a little bit of a hangover, and they could come out pretty flat in the first half. And we were just expecting not a huge crowd just because it was an early game, and, you know, third home game in a row. And, yeah, there is a little bit, just from, you know, from the outside looking in, it does seem to be they are missing that leadership cog a little bit. But, you know, that's definitely something that can be worked out, you know, as the season goes on. And yeah, this whole, you know, unmotivated stuff, that definitely needs to get worked out as well, because it is, you know, these games count no matter who it is. And, you know, even though we did win by, you know, three scores, definitely it didn't feel that way.
Well,
no.
Jeff, can you maybe kind of dig deep a little bit for us? What's it like on an 11 a.m.? Like, when does your game day prep start? What is that process like when you are taking off that early, and how does that maybe negatively affect the team?
Well, we kind of had it differently. You know, my senior year, we had, you know, half of the stadium was built, so we weren't allowed to play night games. So, you know, I think half of our home games were 11 a.m. kicks.
Yeah.
It's definitely really weird, you know, because a lot of guys are, you know, superstitious and, you know, really are into their routine. And I'm definitely one of those guys. I do the same thing even as a fan, you know, wear the same polo and have the same routine going into tailgate. But you know, you're eating your pregame meal, which is normally the same thing every week. So I'd be eating spaghetti and meatballs at 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, or whatever it was. And you know, it's definitely different, because you, for the later kicks, you enjoy kind of hanging out in the hotel room, just relaxing, watching the rest of the country play. And you know, you go through one or two more walkthroughs with a later kick than you do with the early ones. But yeah, it's one of those. It really, you know, it tests your mettle. You got to be ready to go, you know, on the flip of the switch, and you can't have that whole day to get ready, because it's just not going to work out that way. You know, we always get upset, you know, as a fan base, getting an 11 or 12 o'clock kick, but, you know, being ready to go, you know, punch some dudes in the mouth is definitely a little bit harder when you're rolling out of bed at 5:30 or 6.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, even tailgating is harder when it's an 11 o'clock game. I know that I only got out there for a couple of hours beforehand rather than, you know, the typical 6 or whatever it is, because there was no way, first of all, that I was going to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and there's definitely no way that my wife was going to be out there at 6 a.m. So, you know.
It's a lack of commitment, Jamie. It's a lack of commitment on your part as a fan.
Hey, I woke up at 5 and I drove an hour and I was there.
Hey, look, you guys can take it up with her if you want. I'm not, you know, that's a battle that I'm not going to choose to fight.
So. Well, you know, that does kind of bring up an interesting point, too. And there was quite a bit of discussion on Facebook and Twitter about this. And, you know, from our perspective, and from, you know, having a former player on the line here, too's perspective, it was really hot Saturday morning, and there were, I mean, that stadium was emptied out, including the student section, by the second half, and it was pretty obvious that the Frogs had kind of put this thing away. What are your thoughts, Jeff, just on that fan support when it is that, you know, ridiculously warm and almost to the point of being dangerous for some of the older and some of the younger fans too? Do you think that there's a little bit of frustration from the players in those situations? Do you feel frustrated as a former player, now a fan? What are your thoughts just kind of on the crowd support yesterday?
Yeah, we definitely had a bunch of those games where it was super hot. You know, what was that in 2010 against Baylor, when we had a 2 or 3 o'clock kickoff, and we came out in all black, and it was, you know, hot as Hades, and it was, you definitely understand it, and you're, especially in the second half, when things are kind of put away, as a player, you kind of understand. I mean, it is a little, maybe not disappointing is the right word to say, but, I mean, you understand it. You know, the college kids are going to want to leave, and if we're up by 4 touchdowns, you know, you can understand that why they'd go out and, you know, watch the rest of it on the TV, you know, drinking a cold beer. But it's, you know, it's understandable, and it was hot. And it, as a fan, it was kind of, you know, unmotivated as well. But I mean, it is what it is. You know, it's, if the people, when they do show up, they're loud, and, you know, that's all you can ask for. 'Cause, you know, when I got there and, you know, 2007, we would be very, you know, we would be lucky if the whole bottom bowl was sold out and if the students stayed until halftime as it is. But so we're definitely fortunate to have, you know, the support that we have and people coming out and cheering the guys on as much as they can. It's kind of, you know, act of God, extenuating circumstances, you know, 120 degrees sitting on a piece of metal in the sun. But it's I think the fans are doing an incredible job, and you know, I can give them a pass on this one.
Well, I would say that I hope that the football gods smile upon us for the Oklahoma game, which is our next home game. And they've been very unkind to us over the last year plus. And we'll touch a little bit on the injury misfortune Saturday here in a minute. But at least giving us a night game for that big matchup sure would be a nice little turn of events, as opposed to getting that afternoon kickoff, which is starting to look more and more like what we'll be facing. Or Texas, give us a nice little 75-degree day to start off October would also be acceptable.
Yeah, well, you know, it was hot. That's all I can say is it was so hot on Saturday. I was sweating so much until I went into the AC of the press box. But, yeah, it was ridiculous. And I remember being a student because, you know, I was a junior in 2007 or a sophomore in 2007, Jeff. And, you know, I remember very clearly some of those morning games where it's like, okay, well, it's like, all right, we're playing Wyoming and we're going to be up 35-3 at halftime. And at that point, yeah, I will go back and I will turn on, you know, like Alabama Ole Miss, and I'll keep up with the game on another TV in the dorm room. And you know, so I guess I have to apologize to you at this point for being one of those students that left at that at halftime of some of those games. But hey,
no,
I knew because of how good y'all were that it was absolutely in good hands at that point. So.
Oh, absolutely. Nothing would be nearly as bad. And we actually brought this up at a tailgate with a couple of the old heads. We don't want to have to end up playing like UNLV or Wyoming, like you said, during Thanksgiving break or something like that. And there'd be, you know, all 12 people and some parents left over watching the game for the entire time.
Yeah.
Oh, we've come so far, haven't we?
Yeah. I remember I took a bunch of my church kids to a game probably last year in the Mountain West. So was that 2011? And we played New Mexico at home, and that was the game that I took my kids out to, and they had a blast. And then they looked up at this 59-0, and they're like, "Okay, we're gonna like walk around the stadium, and you know, maybe go out and look at campus and all this kind of stuff." So it was a great opportunity to take kids to campus and show them TCU and show them some dominant TCU football. But you know, even high school kids who were so invested in being out there and being present got disinterested when TCU was just absolutely steamrolling someone. So
I mean, you lost me at high school kids getting disinterested in something. I shudder to think that could ever happen.
You know nothing about that, do you, Melissa? Because as a high school teacher, you are so engaging that your kids never have a moment.
That's got to be what it is. Well, let's touch on some of the negative things that happened here on Saturday. And, you know, I think that I've never felt the air get so sucked out of the stadium so quickly as I did when Kevontae Turpin went down. His injury status is still, you know, we're still kind of in wait-and-see mode to see what TCU, what, if anything, they're going to be releasing here in the next couple of days. But I don't know that there's a singular player on that TCU offense right now that does more and fills more roles than Turpin has for this squad for the last year plus. So, you know, best case scenario, maybe he misses a couple of weeks. Worst case scenario, I mean, I know everyone's kind of seen that picture that's been floating around here on Twitter that probably sucks a little bit of the hope out of you too. But if Turpin is going to miss, you know, a game or two or an extended period of time, how do you think Gary Patterson, Sonny Cumbie, Doug Meacham go about filling his role on the offense?
I mean, that's a good question.
Go ahead.
Oh no, you got it, Jeff.
All right, cool. Yeah, it's definitely a bummer. I mean, the kid's got some juice, and you know, anytime he touches the ball, it can go 80 yards for a touchdown, and he's just so exciting to watch, and he's definitely one of those guys that, you know, just enjoys to play the game, and it was definitely a bummer to see that. And you know, I think the OCs are going to have an interesting time trying to find that guy with the ability that can, you know, just take the top off the defense, or just one of those guys you just have to account for, you know, no matter where he is on the field, if he's lined up in the slot or on the outside or in the backfield, you know, there's always got to be one or two sets of eyes on him. And, you know, there are a couple of guys, you know, coming into the season, we definitely had a big old crop of some really, really talented kids at receiver. So there's definitely going to have to be some guys stepping up. You know, if that's, you know, Slanina trying to, you know, do his best Cole Beasley impression, or you know, Taj Williams and all those guys just trying to, you know, make their big circus catches down there and trying to, you know, just do what they can to try and take the top off the defense and just be that big play threat. But, you know, I don't know if you can replace what he does on special teams, like I said, because he's just so exciting to watch, and he's one of those guys that anytime he can touch it, he can take it to the house. And, you know, it'll be an interesting opportunity. You know, maybe, you know, Deontay Gray will be able to get back there and kind of give us a look at what he was before he got hurt and missed all of last year. So it'll be an interesting challenge, I think, for the guys. And, you know, this week coming up will be a good opportunity to test that out, because, you know, SMU's got – they've definitely got an excuse to be unmotivated after losing their starting quarterback. And, you know, hopefully we can just come out there and you know, beat them down really quick and get some guys some good reps in the second half. But it's going to be really interesting to see how they play with that and trying to fill that void.
Yeah, you're definitely right, Jeff, especially about that point about SMU. If you're going to lose a key cog in your offense like Kevontae Turpin, it helps to go up against, you know, kind of a hapless team the next week to sort out those kinks and see who's going to be able to step in and fill that role before you head into a game against Oklahoma, which might not be as big of a threat as we anticipated at the beginning of the season. But either way, it's a game against OU, and you want to be fully ready for that. And so, you know, I think you're right. I think other guys are going to step up. I would like to see Deontay Gray move back to wide receiver and start to fill into that role a little bit. Patterson said that there was an opportunity for him to move back to the offensive side of the ball this week. We can talk about that in a little bit, but you know, just because he is so similar of a player to Kevontae Turpin, he looks like he's completely healthy and mentally over that knee injury that he suffered back in 2014. So I would look to him absolutely to be a guy that can step in and fill in that role. But ultimately, when you've got guys like Taj Williams and John D'Arce and Emmanuel Porter on the outside, those guys are talented and gifted enough for Kenny Hill to be able to get them the ball consistently and for at least one of them to be open on almost every play. So, you know, you don't want to minimize the loss like Kevontae Turpin, but if you're going to lose a key player at any position, you know, wide receiver is the one where you're like, okay, well, it's a devastating injury. especially if he is going to be out for the year, which we're not sure on that yet. But at least there is a lot of talent and depth still at that unit that can kind of step in and start to fill those shoes a little bit.
See, my concern, though, is not necessarily losing a wide receiver. It's losing a game breaker. You know, I haven't seen another wide receiver this year that can get a little 5-yard curl or a little stick pattern, take the ball out of the backfield and be a threat to break it every single time. You know, Sean Mixon, we hadn't lost him before the season. There's another similar guy, not quite as quick, obviously, but kind of a similar type of player. And the thing that Turpin does, again, we just haven't seen anybody else do this year, is he can completely change the momentum of a game every time he touches the ball. He did it against South Dakota State with that punt return. He did it against Arkansas three times in the return game. And I just don't know who else is out there. Tejada just doesn't look as quick. And I know they were trying to adjust on the fly Saturday, and he's probably not going to be the guy returning kicks and punts next week. But, you know, who is going to be that special magical player that every time he touches the ball, even if he doesn't break one all the way, he's probably going to get the crowd into it in a way that just nobody else has been able to do that yet. So I think it's concerning. I think he takes away a lot of your little bit of your magic and your mojo. But, you know, like you guys have both said, there's a lot of other talented guys on this team that can kind of help fill that role. I'm just waiting to see if there's one of those players that has that juice to kind of take a game over, you know, just with a single touch or a big punt return or by breaking a big one down to the house, because we haven't seen Kenny Hill look real accurate on the long ball yet. It's been mostly guys kind of making plays in space. And so, you know, if we can't get someone to consistently come down with the deep ball, then somebody else is going to have to be able to get involved and make big plays with their feet.
You're right. My only counter to that, especially about the return game thing, would be, you know, we were all saying and thinking the same things when Cam Eccles-Looper decided to transfer before last season.
True.
And we were all like, well, crap, that really, who is going to return kicks and punts? And you just don't know until someone kind of steps into that role. And maybe there is a guy, maybe it's Desmond White, who has done it in the past a little bit, that steps into that role and can actually be a lights out guy. I'm not trying to minimize a loss like Kevontae Turpin, because you can't replace him with just one body. But, you know, next man up always kind of, you know, that if someone has that next man up mentality and steps into that role and is ready to rock, you know, good things can still happen. So
this is true. Well, you know, we didn't see Ty catch a single pass on Saturday morning. Isaiah Graham wasn't even dressed out. I don't know if that was an injury issue or just a numbers issue for the game Saturday. He was wearing shorts on the sideline. So there's still guys that didn't get an opportunity to play against Iowa State or make a big impact against Iowa State that, you know, will have a chance, like you said, to kind of take that mentality. And Lord knows this team knows enough about next man up. We've been through it a lot here the last couple of years.
I think I'm just so callous and jaded from last season, losing one or two starters a game. I think I'm just kind of adapting that same mentality.
Mm-hmm. You know, because you saw what happened when next man up stepped up last year. You know, you had Jalen Austin and Jerison Stewart come in and be just playmakers for the last half of the season, especially in that bowl game. So, you know, it's all a matter of not getting too defeated by the guys going down around you. And really just, you know, trusting the offense and trusting the guys that are still around you suited up and playing to all go out. And like Henson said last week, and Deontay Gray said it in his post-game interview, do your 111th. I'm sure that's something that you're familiar with, Jeff, too, is if everyone's doing their 111th, then everything's going to get done the way it needs to.
Yeah, definitely. That got forcibly pounded into my head, you know, every single day. And you kind of take that with you even when you stop playing football too. But you know, if you take care of your job, and if everybody has that same mentality, instead of I just do my job and not have to worry about doing somebody else's, you know, good things are going to happen. And we definitely saw that in that bowl game. And you know, there's definitely some opportunities for some new guys to come through and kind of make their mark. And like I said, it's a good opportunity this week coming up. Just because it's one of those, it's not that, you know, that traditional power or whatever, you know, what have you. You know, however, SMU always does play TCU very, very well every year. And but yeah, it's going to be, like I said, it's going to be very interesting to see who's going to step up. as well as who's going to, you know, make moves in practice and maybe unseat a starter and things like that. But yeah, as long as everybody's doing their job, you know, good things tend to happen.
Yeah, and speaking of good things tending to happen, Kenny Hill seems to be progressing from game to game. This game was his first turnover-free game as a Horned Frog, which is a big deal, I think, especially as we head into conference play after this SMU game on Friday. He wasn't as spectacular. His stats weren't nearly as flashy, but he looked like he was really getting into a rhythm with some of his receivers, especially John D'Arce, and he just – it felt to me like he was more in control of the offense. He missed a few throws that he should have made. He had a couple wide open guys that he just straight up missed on. But how do y'all feel after seeing him in his first Big 12 game not turn the ball over? The offense as a whole was a little bit more consistent. So how do y'all feel about Hill's performance?
Well, I think that the best thing that happened with the offense on Saturday was that, I mean, we ran the ball. The Frogs had 37 rushing attempts compared to 22 passing attempts, or 30 passing attempts by Kenny Hill, five more by Foster Sawyer. Hicks got 12 carries, Derek Green got 10 carries, Johnson got four. Hill only had to run the ball five times, and maybe only about half of those were designed running plays, but you know, when your running game is working, and this is, get your shot glass ready, people. When your running game is working, it makes everything so much easier for the quarterback. And instead of asking Kenny Hill to throw bombs all game, which is what it seemed like he'd been just trying to force that deep ball, play after play the first two games of the season, it was a little bit shorter passes. They still took their chances, still tried to take the top off the defense, had two really nice deep ball attempts and one really great completion Porter, which on that beautiful goal line play. He was a little bit more comfortable. They were working the ball inside. I thought he got pretty good protection from the offensive line against, a little bit of an impotent pass rush by Iowa State. But regardless, he was a little more comfortable. They were giving him throws to get his confidence up. His receivers, he still had a couple kind of egregious drops, but for the most part, were making plays for him and just kind of allowing him to just kind of matriculate the ball down the field with a little bit more consistency and without taking quite as many chances as we've seen him take in the first 2 weeks. So the play calling helped. He executed really, really well for the most part. And Kyle Hicks, did a good job too of making him look good.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the run game is definitely helping him out. And he definitely did seem to have a little bit more composure this year or this week as, compared to the other two, even when he was being chased out of the pocket, he kind of kept his cool and was able to keep his eyes downfield and really wasn't looking for that home run play every single time. We were very fortunate when Trayvon was still here and he hit a couple of those home runs and sometimes it's just kind of how it goes. Some days you get lucky with the jump ball, other days you don't. It was good to see them dial it back a little bit and know that we don't have to get 30 yards, and I'll go ahead and do some coach speak too, Melissa. Home runs don't always win it. Sometimes you win it with singles and doubles, and they can single and double their way down the field and keep the tempo up, and that was good to see. They were able to pump up the tempo a little bit and kind of dink and dunk down the field, and they put some really, really good drives together, and there was a lot more improvement from the week before. And a few less penalties, shooting ourselves in the foot, and so that was definitely very good to see. But I think the best thing was seeing even when he was under duress, Kenny was able to keep his composure and scan his receivers and make the not necessarily the most exciting play, but the best play for the given situation. And I think he's going to do great. And not turning the ball over is awesome. But what were our stats when? Every game that Boykin threw a touchdown, we won, or threw an interception, we won, and stuff like that. So if he turns it over every once in a while, that's kind of the other side of the coin with the air raid or frog raid or whatever we call it. But I think definitely keeping the running game up and those big boys, Travoris and Green from Michigan, definitely kind of remind me a little bit of Joe Turner back in the day and those big balling guys that can you know, get 5 yards and just wear down a defense. But, yeah, a lot of good things that I saw from Kenny.
Well, you know, TT had 2 9-play drives, scoring drives, and 2 11-play scoring drives. I don't know the last time we've seen, you know, 4 9-plus play drives in the same game by the TCU team, but I would venture to say it was probably before 2014. So a little bit of an old school mentality for TCU, but it seemed to be effective.
Yeah, and Jeff, you brought up a really good point about turnovers, because it seems more this year than in years past, and maybe it's just because of Kenny Hill's past, but it seems like every time this kid makes a mistake, people are so ready to jump all over him. And so it happened again.
Started on this.
Dude, it happened again on Saturday, and yeah, let's get into it, because it frustrates the heck out of me. I don't know how you feel about it. Because this kid has done everything right by all accounts since he stepped on campus, won the job in August, which means, in my mind, he was better than Foster Sawyer. So I can't comprehend why, after 3 games, when he has racked up, I believe it's close to 1,300 yards of total offense and 11 touchdowns and 3 turnovers, why people are so hell-bent on criticizing him and blaming him for the majority of the offense's inconsistencies and really wanting to see more of Foster Sawyer. It's mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, and I think it's all coming from a good place, and we're so spoiled as a fan base just because we've had such success and you know, we've had consistency at the quarterback position. You know, we had Dalton for 4 years, had Boykin for, 3 years. And, you know, that same guy's been back there throwing the rock every single week for, you know, an entire season. And, you know, he's new. He's the new guy. So, you know, I was kind of ready for it. But, you know, I mean, the kid's a ball player. All that's fine. You know, the thing that I love about Kenny, and this isn't, you know, speaking ill on Foster Sawyer at all, because from everything I've heard is he's just, you know, an incredible guy as well. But just the way he was able to shed his Kenny Trill mantra or whatever it was that happened down at College Station, and he left it down there. And, when Gary said that he's been, you know, such a great leader and he's working so hard and, he's with, you know, Kylan Moore and those other guys being mentors to the kids of Fort Worth. And he just seems like that's such a great person. Maybe that's kind of why I'm a little biased and saying, telling people to hold off just cause he is such a good dude. He's balling right now. He's playing well. With the style of offense we play, turnovers are going to happen. He may force some things, and Boykin's forced things too. And he's either thrown a bad pick or somebody came over the incredible catch, and Dalton forced some things, and Paul Hall forced some things, and that's what happens with the way the game of football is played now. That's going to happen, and you're given plenty of opportunities to make up for it with how quick, you know, offenses can score and all that stuff, but. It's really mind boggling, just like you said. But I think it just comes that we're really very spoiled, and we've had some great teams come through and a lot of success. I mean, it comes from a good place. But it's one of those things, you know, we're not going to beat everybody by 60 points. You know, I don't know if anybody, I don't think some people realize how difficult it is to go undefeated every single year. Like look at the last two CFP champs. They each had a loss at home at the beginning of the season. And it's so hard to go undefeated and to be that dominant team. And, you know, week in and week out, we saw Florida State had, you know, squeakers after squeakers, and Bama struggling with Ole Miss every year. And the guys wearing the different color jersey, you know, they're on scholarship too. They play football as well. And, you know, that's their job while they're in school. And, you know, they're good players all over this country, and not every good player can go to TCU, and can go to Texas, and can go to Ohio State, blah blah blah. So they go to these other places and they make plays because that's what they're called upon to do. And it's one of those things where we've had a lot of success, and got the ball to bounce our way, you know, for a while. And now that, you know, whether it's the football gods or what have you, just kind of making things right or whatever it is, you know, I tend to ride a little bit more on the positivity train and try and talking people off of the ledge. And it just, it's frustrating to see, you know, if when we played SMU last year and, you know, as soon as we didn't blow them out by, you know, four touchdowns, everybody was like, oh, we're never going to beat it. We're not going to beat Baylor. We're not going to beat Texas, blah, 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 blah. It's like, just hold on, man. You know, the football it's not a basketball. It's not going to bounce the same way every single time. And so it's one of those things you have to relax, enjoy the season. One outcome does not by any means, you know, determine the rest of the season. And you know, that definitely, you know, comes with the territory, but, you know, I think that kind of defines Kenny too. And he's working really hard and, you know, I think we can all see it. But he's the new guy. So I think he's just going to be, you know, catch the brunt of it, you know, until he keeps throwing touchdowns and keep putting up 200-400 yards a game. And then everybody's going to come around and we're all going to sit back and laugh at how silly we were thinking of, you know, getting him off the field.
Yeah, you're definitely right. I think people forget how much they were calling for Casey Paul to hurry back from his injury after he broke his arm in 2013 because of the way that Boykin was playing quarterback for the majority of that season. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we just got to give the guy time. You know, running on the scout team for a year after, you know, having sat out for half season plus at A&M, you can't compare that to playing in live games. And so he's three games in after being out for 18 months. Let him settle in. His decision-making has improved every game he's played. He doesn't have Josh Doctson to throw to. And up until yesterday, really, he didn't have a dominant running game to back him up either. So it's early. I think I think where Kenny Hill can win over the fan base is obviously, you know, we don't want to look ahead too much here, but his performance against OU as he goes kind of, you know, head-to-head here with Baker Mayfield could go a long way into kind of giving him a little bit of a bump on that national stage as opposed to having everybody just kind of look at the box score and say, well, TCU's not blowing teams out. He's turning the ball over. It must be his fault. And obviously there's so much more to it than that.
Yeah, definitely. He's only one of 11 guys on the field, and he's only one of, you know, 30-plus that has an impact on the game, and that's just for one of the two teams that's on the field on any given Saturday. So, you know, he is the quarterback. He does have the ball in his hands every play for the offense, but, you know, it's not all on his shoulders, and it's not all his fault when the things aren't going well. But, you know, one of those guys, Deontay Gray, he played cornerback on Saturday. It was his second time to play or to start at cornerback since he's been at TCU. The last time that he started at cornerback was against Iowa State two seasons ago, I believe, which is a very interesting fact. So his two starts at corner have both come against Iowa State. And so he was one of the four player interviews after the game on Saturday. And he talked a little bit about moving to corner. And then he talked a little bit about Patterson suggesting that he could move back to wide receiver on Friday, I guess, against SMU. And, you know, he said he just always makes sure that he is ready to play whenever his number is called, at whatever position he's called to play. But, Jeff, you played mostly guard, I believe, when you were at TCU. Is that right?
I was tackle.
You were a tackle. That's right. I'm sorry. So
no worries.
Did you switch positions much at all? Like, did you move along the offensive line at all, or were you pretty much locked in?
My junior year, I played right tackle. So all throughout that, summer, I did get a start at left tackle, once, but it, you know, 99% of the time I was lining up at right tackle, and then the senior year, so that would have been the, you know, 2011, they switched me over about halfway through 2 days from right tackle to left tackle.
So I know that it's not switching from offense to defense, but it's still, you're doing almost everything in reverse from what I could imagine, moving from one side of the line to the other.
Yeah.
So what is that like mentally as a player, having to make that adjustment on the fly and kind of break it down for Melissa and I and for those listening. What mentally is Deonte Greig going through right now as he's adjusting to playing a new position and then maybe moving back? And just what are you trying to do mentally as a player to make sure that whenever you're on the field at whatever position, you're performing at a high level?
Well, you know, from my perspective, you know, it really doesn't even hold a candle to what he's trying to do. You know, everything, you know, for me was, you know, listening to the play and remembering, all right, so I'm on the backside of this play versus when I was on the, you know, the play side of this one, and just understanding, you know, where I'm at in the play. But that's completely different from what he's having to do. And he's altering what he's been doing from the start of fall camp up until now, and going from, you know, sprinting forward and cutting to, you know, back pedals and, you know, flipping his hips and trying to cover a receiver. And, you know, but he's definitely got the attitude. It's, you know, whatever's going to be asked of me. You know, he knows he's a great athlete. Everybody else knows he's a great athlete. So he's going to be, you know, people are going to expect him to come out and play well. And it's one of those things where, you know, it's, you can't really give him too much flack if he gives up a deep ball, or, you know, if he gets, you know, out jumped for a whatever it is, just because he is out there. He's one of the few players around the nation that gets the opportunity to play on both sides of the ball. And granted, he's not, you know, starting at receiver and then starting at corner. But, you know, just making that switch, you know, midway through the week or whenever it was, it's a lot to ask. And, you know, he seemed like he really answered the call. But moving forward, you know, I think he'll just have that mentality. You know, it's like, all right, you know, I could be playing on this side of the ball and somebody gets hurt and I need to go move over to the other side. And I think he's definitely ready to answer that call. And, you know, with the off year that he had last year, he was able to, you know, really get in the playbook and understand the offense from a wide receiver perspective. So, you know, that way, if he gets called to move over from defense to offense, you know, it's kind of his second nature. But it's definitely going to be a cool story for him to tell, just to be that guy that say, hey, listen, man, you know, we really need you on this side of the ball. So you got to, you know, change your entire mentality from being a defender to going up and getting the ball and taking it for the score versus trying to knock it down or pick it off or, you know, what have you. So it's going to be a fun challenge for him. And it's going to be, hopefully he'll be real successful at it. And we'll be praising him at the end of the year for being a two-way guy.
Well, and I wonder too, and I don't know that we'll ever know the answer to this, but I think you said that really eloquently. It's just that kind of that mentality of go where I'm needed and help my team win. And I mean, that's one thing we've always loved about Deonte Greig. He's always been a very unselfish player, always had a great attitude on and off the field. And just, you know, I think it was devastating to lose him last year because of how much the fans really did love watching him play. But, you know, I wonder what goes into that decision. You know, I wonder if it's just coincidental that it's against Iowa State, or if there's something specifically about that team that Patterson feels he's got an advantage putting Greig out there. Is that an indictment on our corners who have obviously struggled a little bit to this point this year? Is it a health issue, you know, with Tejada not being 100%? Maybe he just wanted to get somebody else out there. There's so many questions as to why we were surprised with that news Saturday morning, you know, and when Greig went to warm up with the corners over the wide receivers. And, you know, I'm wondering, was it just a one-game thing? Was it just out of need? Or is that something where Gary doesn't feel super confident in what's happening on that side of the ball and tried to throw somebody else in the mix just to see if he could change the chemistry?
Yeah, I think it was definitely just trying to switch things up a little bit and, you know, use it as a motivating factor, you know, for Tejada up there saying, you know, hey, you know, you've got to play better. If you're not 100%, you know, that is what it is. But we've got guys that can play, and, you know, it's not a, hey, if you can't play, you know, don't go out there, I'll replace you. But it's, you know, we've got guys, you know, so if you want to be out there on Saturday or on Fridays, and, you know, to step it up. And it could just be just a motivating factor, or it could have been simply because, you know, Tejada's not 100%, or it was a confidence thing. And, you know, he didn't play his best game against Arkansas. And so he could have given him an opportunity to kind of, you know, relax a little bit and understand that, you know, there are guys that can play. But I don't know for sure. I mean, he does so many crazy things that end up working out, and we all look stupid for suggesting otherwise. who really knows?
Yeah, it's one of those things where Gary's going to do what Gary needs to do to make his team come out on top. And hey, if Gray is willing and has the right mentality about it and can do things on both sides of the ball, why not give him an opportunity to make plays whenever he can, because he's proven in the past that he's a playmaker and he needs to be on the field. One guy who showed himself as possibly being a playmaker moving forward is the guy who made his TCU debut yesterday, and that was Matt Bozen along the defensive line. Patterson was hesitant to praise him after the game, even though Bozen had two sacks and looked decent getting pressure on the quarterback, said that he missed some reads in the run game, didn't get off his blocks well at some points. But on the whole, Bozen and the whole defensive line looked like they had a pretty good day. So, Melissa, let's get your thoughts first, and then, Jeff, your thoughts. What does this say moving forward if the defensive line can continue to get the kind of success that they saw against Iowa State?
Well, first, I don't know that there's anything more encouraging than Patterson, kind of dropping somebody for some ticky-tack things on a day where he had a 1.5 sacks. That to me makes me think, okay, Patterson thinks this guy's a chance to be special, and he's just going to keep holding him down to not let him get big-headed. So he'll keep playing with a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. So that's a great sign, in my opinion, just based off of Patterson's history. But, the biggest thing that's been lacking on the defensive front for TCU has been the defensive front. And, Austin Allen and Taron Christian both had so much time to throw in the first two games. They both played, probably the best games of their career against TCU. And a lot of that was more indicative of the lack of pressure that they faced in the backfield than it was, just making perfect throws and burning DBs deep, although they did plenty of that as well. So to see guys like Bozen and to see guys like McFarland and Curry had a great sack. They lived in the Iowa State backfield, and the Cyclones offensive line is a bit of a jumbled mess. And, even the wide right Natty Light guys talked about that leading up to the game. And so that's the game where they needed to come in and absolutely dominate an opposing front. And they did that. And so they did what they needed to do. They were effective. They kept pressure on Lanning. They made life difficult for him. Mike Warren never really got going, which, was also a big part of keeping Alan Lazard from having a big game. Warren did end up with 95 yards, but it took him 23 carries to do it, and a lot of that was garbage time runs in the second half. So I was happy to see them kind of to compact the pocket, to get a hand up in the face, to get some tips, and just wreak havoc in the front, and that made the defensive backs look a lot better, made the linebackers look a lot better, and, it all does legitimately start up front. So, can they do this again against SMU next week? Can they do this against Oklahoma? Is this the start of a positive pattern? Obviously, as TC fans, that's what we're hoping, is that the five sacks Saturday, which matched the total of the two games combined, are just kind of the jumping off point for an offensive line that we thought would be the most dominant position group of the defensive unit, if not the entire team. So to see all those guys rotate in, Tippa Galea had a great game. I just think there was a lot of positive things to take through it. Now we need to see them be consistent with the pressure that they're getting on the quarterback.
Yeah. I thought Bozen looked well. He definitely looks the part. So I was glad to see him get out there and play to how he looks coming off the bus. but they definitely cause a lot of pressure, and they always told us, when it's, they get one or two hits on the quarterback, even if he gets, if he gets the throw off, he'll have happy feet for a while, even if there isn't pressure. So it was good to see a lot of guys, getting that pressure on the quarterback, even if they weren't, getting a sack or getting a pressure or a QB hit. They definitely knew that if I don't get rid of this ball, somebody's coming. And being able to rotate those guys in and out, especially with the speed of the Big 12 offenses that we're going to play, moving forward, like Oklahoma and Tech and Baylor and all those guys, being able to have different platoons of those guys to come in, with fresh legs and be able to keep that same pressure up is going to be, beneficial moving forward. And it's definitely a positive sign, um, for,
for, you know, Coach P trying to find a reason to bring them back down to earth, which is always a good thing for anybody to do, and, you know, keeping them humble and keeping them honest and always have something to work on, you know, and not think that he's officially arrived just yet. But yeah, there was definitely a lot of pressure, you know, on the quarterback, and that helped out the defensive backs immensely and allowed the linebackers to run free a little bit and make some more plays here and there. So that's one of those things that's going to be kind of the focus, I think, for the defense moving forward. It's just if they're able to sustain that pressure over the course of 3, 4, 5 games and being able to rotate those guys in, and, you know, no matter who it is, somebody's getting free and getting a hand on the quarterback and letting them know that he's like, hey, you're not alone back here. You know, I'm getting you next time. But it was definitely a good thing to see as a Frog fan.
I definitely agree with that. You know, it is concerning, though, to me, beyond just getting pressure and the coverage looking better in this game. You know, TCU's defense has only forced one turnover so far this year through 3 games. And I think TCU fans and TCU, you know, especially Gary Patterson, is used to seeing this defense force a lot of turnovers. We saw it so much in 2014. We saw it less in 2015, but still more often than we've seen through the first 3 games. You know, at some point, this defense has to make a play that causes, you know, that gives their offense the short field, or, you know, really is sending a message to the team on the other side of the field that they're here to play. Do you see this defense getting to a point where they are starting to force turnovers, or is this a team that's really just going to have that bend don't break mentality and the offense is always going to see a long field?
I mean, there has not been a lot of tipped balls. There hasn't been a lot of, you know, strip sack looking plays. I don't know if that's, you know, more of an issue with maybe the poorer tackling we've seen so far this year. They're kind of diving at guys' feet and not really getting in there and trying to punch the ball out and, you know, keep a guy that's upright, you know, instead of ripping the ball out, they're letting him push the pile is kind of been what's happening so far this year. You know, until the cornerback play picks up, I don't think we're going to see a lot of turnovers unless the defensive line can keep living in the backfield. Obviously, there's always opportunity to knock the ball out of the quarterback's hands or something like that. But these defensive backs haven't, you know, been able to get their hands up in time to kind of tip the ball up in the air to let some of those crazy things happen. So if you're going to win a lot of games, you know, in a college football season, especially in kind of what's been a crazy year like this, you're going to have to force turnovers. And, you know, other than that fumble that happened against South Dakota State, we haven't even seen anything be close, you know, to a turnover or reviewable for a turnover or give the crowd a little bit of hope that maybe this one's going to go our way. So I think it's concerning. And, you know, it is. It's a momentum thing as much as anything. And if you think that our return game is going to take a little bit of a step back, if Turpin's out, that's somewhere where, you know, the defense can kind of pick up a little bit of that mojo and momentum and change the game that way. And you know, with some of the big boys coming up here in the next 2 weeks, getting a couple of fumbles, getting an interception, getting a pick six, you know, a fumble recovery for a touchdown, things like that could really be difference makers in some of these games against evenly matched teams or teams that might be slightly better than TCU's right now too.
Yeah, I think they're definitely going to need, you know, some of those quick turnovers and giving the offense a short field and allowing them to score quickly and put a lot more pressure on the opposing offense is going to be big. You know, not just, you know, allowing our own defense to rest a little bit longer, but just, you know, having those, you know, when you see a team scoring 14 points and, you know, a minute and a half or whatever it is, but just being able to get those turnovers instead of allowing them, you know, getting a 3-and-out and allowing a punter to get off a big kick and flip the field. And it'll help all facets of the game for sure. If the linebackers can push the ball out a little bit or some of those safeties that come across the field and make a big time interception, will definitely help out the offense as well. Just giving them a short field and allow them to attack quicker and you know, just get the ball in the end zone as quick as they can and putting a lot more pressure on the opposing offense.
Yeah, I agree with pretty much everything you guys said. You're so smart, both of you. This is why it's fun to do a radio show with smart people, because you guys just can carry it and it's all great. It's all great. One thing that I've really found to be giving for me through 3 weeks in the season, even though TCU football has looked very inconsistent, and it felt like just by watching these first three games that any shot of, you know, like winning the Big 12 and doing something significant in postseason felt like it kind of has gone down the drain, especially after that loss to Arkansas, is that this Big 12 is so bad and so wide open at this point that even through TCU's first three games where they've been very inconsistent, you know, I am slightly less, but not very much less confident that TCU can still, you know, be near the top, if not at the top of the Big 12 standings at the end of the season. So I want to go into some of the other Big 12 scores from the weekend in a minute, but first just tell me, do you guys think I'm crazy for thinking that, or is it something that you think could actually happen?
Jeff, I'll let you take first stab at this one.
Yeah, I think it's definitely possible. You know, you see, like you said, going over the scores of the rest of the Big 12 here in a minute. But yeah, I mean, you know, Texas Tech couldn't stop a runny nose, and you know, Texas is super, super inconsistent in and of themselves, and you know, they're, you know, Baylor isn't looking as good as and as, you know, strong offensively as they have in the past either, and you know, there's definitely a lot of room. You know, there's a lot of wiggle room, and you know, it's probably not going to be big time blowouts of a traditional Big 12 power, but it's going to be a you know, 10-14 point victory, you know, of whoever it is. But it's, you know, there's definitely a lot of room in around college football as a whole. You know, there's you know, top 25 teams dropping left and right, and you know, idiots scheduling North Dakota State, and there's a lot of time for chaos to reign supreme. And you know, I say it in jest, but I still kind of believe it. You know, the last two, 100% of the college football playoff champions have won with one loss on the record at home at the beginning of the season. So I'm going to leave it at that.
Yeah, and you know, it is going to be a weird year. That's all I can say.
I agree. And I think, you know, people forget that, who was it? Was it Ohio State that lost to Virginia Tech at home?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
A 6-6 Virginia Tech team like that. There's, you know, if and I know that it's Ohio State by 14. Yeah. By two touchdowns at home against the Virginia Tech team that went on to lose to some not very good opponents after that. And, you know, I have a feeling based on watching Arkansas's first 3 weeks that they are not going to be 6-6 this year, that they're going to be better than 6-6. You know, I have them, you know, pegged, especially after this week of football, to finish maybe second in the SEC West. I don't think A&M is that good. Auburn is a dumpster fire. If they can contain Ole Miss, I think, you know, it's Alabama, then it's Arkansas, then it's LSU, Ole Miss, A&M, and all the rest. You know, I think that was a very good team that TCU played in week two, and people just don't quite know that yet. So, yeah, I'm very confident that TCU is going to do big things in the Big 12 still, especially because you have Ohio State going to Norman and winning 45-24. And Melissa, I mentioned this last week, and I'll mention it again. I am still waiting for the hate to start fueling Baker Mayfield to some good performances. I don't know if it's ever going to happen. I don't know, because there's not only is there plenty of hate, but I feel like there might be some hate coming from Sooners fans at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And so my curiosity is when does the hate become so much that it actually does start to trigger consistently good, consistently elite Heisman level play that we were all, you know, told was going to just flow out of Baker Mayfield in 2016.
Well, you know, Baker, God bless him. This poor guy jumped on board his own hype train in the off season and did all the talk and all the magazine covers and all the radio shows and talked about how he wanted everybody to hate him. And so sure enough, everybody started to hate him. Now every time he steps foot on the field, he has to be the guy. He needs to be the one that they're talking about after the game. They're talking about during the game. They're talking about before the game. He's got to live up to the standard that he set for himself. And when you do that and the opposing team knows that you do that and your backup quarterback has a big mouth and went and riled up the last team on the planet you want to rile up, that's usually not going to end very well for you. And so I feel for him. Here you go, Baker. Here's a little more. I don't like the kid, but I do think he's a heck of a college football player. And I'm not going to say I don't take any joy in seeing Oklahoma once again, you know, kind of fall hard on their haunches after being hyped in the preseason. But at the same time, like, I don't feel like this is, you know, him just coming out and thinking he's got it all. I think it's him coming out and trying to prove that he's the guy that he said he was. And that's forcing him to make big mistakes and to put the ball in places he shouldn't, to try to do too much and try to win the game himself. And again, I put this more on Lincoln Riley than I do Baker Mayfield. You have the probably best backfield in the country between Joe Mixon and Samaje Perine, and they did a better job of getting them involved last night. But give them the ball 2 out of every 3 downs and let them wear teams out. Keep your defense off the field because it is terrible. Your corners couldn't stop anybody at this point. Let those two guys just pound away at a defense until eventually they get broken down. And then in the second half, let Baker Mayfield do his thing. Get him out of the pocket. Let him go on some bootlegs. Let him run some option play. Let him get moving around a little bit because the offensive line isn't all that great for the Sooners this year either. And, you know, give him a chance to make some plays in the second half instead of asking him to do so much in the first half that he ends up turning it over or you know, a couple bounces don't go his way, like that fluky pick six, that wasn't really his fault. And then he's trying to force the issue, and that's when things really spiraled out of control for the Sooners last night.
Yeah, I mean, he's got – so, you know, just – let's do a quick stats comparison. I know that Oklahoma has played Ohio State and that they played Houston, and we can get into all of that later about strength of schedule to this point, blah, blah, blah. Quick stats comparison. Baker Mayfield, through 3 games this year, has 793 passing yards, 7 passing touchdowns, 2 interceptions. He has 4 rushing yards through 3 games this year. 4 rushing yards through 3 games this year. Meanwhile, Kenny Trill Hill has, let's see here, that would be 1,035 passing yards and 166 rushing yards, 10 total touchdowns, and 3 turnovers. And nobody's calling for Baker Mayfield's head, are they? Over in Soonerland? Maybe they are. But it's ridiculous to me, and I know I'm backtracking here a little bit, it's ridiculous that people are hating so much on Kenny Hill, when statistically, at least, he's light years ahead. He's lapping Baker Mayfield through 3 weeks in the season. Maybe that will give Horned Frog fans pause. Yeah.
If you're a Sooners fan, you're Bob Stoops, you've got Kyler Murray sitting up there on the bench for next year. At this point, 3 games into the season, you a little salty, Baker, about that extra year eligibility, or are you still feeling pretty good about that?
Well, Kyler couldn't play this year anyways, right? Because the transfer.
Well, no, but I'm saying for next year. I'm saying for next year. Baker's got, you know, they fought tooth and nail.
Oh,
and they complained and cried. And all of a sudden now Baker can stick around next year. And he's, you know, he's probably not a high NFL draft pick after this season, no matter what he does, because he just doesn't look the part of an NFL QB. So that could, you know, not to jump to 2017 already, but that could be a really interesting QB battle up in Norman if things don't turn around for the Sooners this year.
Very true. You know, we're kind of seeing, you know, I was thinking about this the other day. We're seeing this career arc from Baker Mayfield that is mirroring almost perfectly the same career arc that Jevon Snead had. Do y'all remember Jevon Snead?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. The Texas quarterback who won the job, then lost the job, transferred to Ole Miss, had a baller first season at Ole Miss, should have gone to the NFL draft, was projected to be a top 10 pick in the NFL draft that season, came back to Ole Miss for his senior year and bombed, and is like never even got a shot in the NFL, I don't think. I don't know. I was thinking about that the other day. Baker Mayfield is having a Jevon Snead-like career to me.
I don't know what y'all thought about that, but yeah.
I think it's really Manziel-esque in a sense. I know he was in the conversation for the Heisman and all that stuff, but you know he's a very very talented athlete and his escapability is kind of second to none. And I said it on Twitter. Everybody praises him for this gunslinger mentality, you know. But it's not. You know, last year he got bailed out a ton by having Mixon and Pirine or just Pirine, and then having Sterling Shepard on the outside and mm-hmm. being able to bail him out like Mike Evans could do for Johnny, and then everybody kind of figured it out, and then he wasn't as successful, and then people realized, all right, if you try and keep him in the pocket, he's really not a good thrower as what you think it is, but the guy's a heck of an athlete. And he can throw on the run, but I think when you let him sit back there and you get a little bit of pressure on him, then he kind of starts to fold a little bit, and the his true colors kind of come out a little bit. So I thought that was interesting, just having, riding the high of last season where he was so successful and people really got their first chance of seeing him in an offense like at Oklahoma versus what he was doing at Texas Tech. But I just thought it kind of mirrored the Snead thing is something I didn't even think about, but I thought it was very Manziel-esque in a way.
I think that's great. I think they're both great comparisons. But I will say this, I think that the one thing Baker has those other two guys don't is, I think he definitely has a future spot on Dancing with the Stars here a few years down the line. So
oh, God.
At least he can always fall back on that.
Yeah, he and Ryan Lochte both.
Oh yeah, dude. They just seem like they'd be friends. I could see those two just throwing out together.
Have a future of throwing out. Yeah, absolutely, they do.
Oh,
my goodness, we should get them connected. We should see if they have contacts that can put those two in touch, because they would light the world on fire. That would be one hell of a reality show. I'll tell you that. I would watch every single second of that reality show if the two of them just traipsing around.
Oh,
I
man.
Feel like the two of them would be drapes. That would be the word to describe their movements. But Oklahoma isn't the only team in the Big 12 that kind of got showed up on Saturday night. Texas went to Cal looking to avenge a ridiculous loss that their special teams caused in 2015 when Cal came to Austin. Everyone kind of expected Shane Buechele to step up in week 3 and be even better than he was in the first 2 weeks. He got a little bit dinged up in this game, but did manage to finish it. But Texas ends up losing to Cal 50-43. And so we see this defense that Charlie Strong was supposed to have revitalized at this point once again give up 50 points. Is that the second time? No, they gave up, 47 to Notre Dame? Yeah, 47 to Notre Dame and now 50 to Cal. And this defense is supposed to be good. Shane Buechele, who got banged up, only completed, 50-something percent of his passes, threw a touchdown, threw a pick. Deonta Foreman, though, was a baller in this game. He ran for 157 yards and 2 touchdowns. But, I think after Notre Dame lost last night to Michigan State and now Texas loses to Cal, I don't even know where to go with this. Just, it's a ridiculous thing to me that Texas was so hyped and now they're, they've lost to Cal. A Cal team, Melissa, that we talked about last week is not even being good with Jared Goff. And now they're horrible. They just lost to San Diego State the week prior. And now they're out here putting up 50 on Texas.
That's your AP poll rank San Diego State, though, isn't it? So,
there you go.
What a great moment for Davis Webb. He kind of is the guy that gets lost in all the Baker Mayfield drama, but what a great moment for another kid who, he kind of survived through the Baker stuff. He got displaced by Patrick Mahomes, which, 3 games in, can't blame Kingsbury there. Mahomes has been just unbelievable yet again. We can get to that, but what a neat moment for him. I'm just utterly dismayed at what's happened to the Texas defense. The amount of 4 and 5-star guys they have on that side of the ball, and mind you, they are young, and that does obviously play a factor into it. But when you are controlling the game that much offensively with the running game, and your defense still gives up 50 points, I just don't get it. It's just I didn't stay up for this one. Sorry, guys. I went to bed, but that Cal team is going to get rocked in the Pac-12. They're not going to finish the season, you know, as a real competitor for the Pac-12 title. It's just not in their cards. And that loss could come back to look really, really bad for the Texas Longhorns. Shane Buechele's first road test, he put up, he came back from injury, but I think that's one thing to watch as well. He's not a big guy as a true freshman. He's an early enrollee, so he was able to pack on a little bit of muscle, but this is not a big guy. And, you know, if he's going to start getting banged up, that's something that could certainly hurt the Longhorns, because we're starting to see Tyrone Swoops look a little more Tyrone Swoopsy. And a little bit less like the guy who put the Longhorns. Yeah, Swoopsy. I'm going to go ahead and patent that one. he looks a little bit more like the guy we kind of expected them to be. And you know, Texas looked like an offensive juggernaut, but that defense is not something you expect to see from a Charlie Strong defense. With what this guy has done with less talent, to see him have his team kind of fall apart in the early going here with as much talent as they have, that's got to be concerning if you're a Longhorn fan.
Yeah, I think you know, as soon as they put up that big win against Notre Dame and everybody was coming out of the woodwork saying Texas is back, you know, you kind of knew something was going to happen. It was a little early for them to make however big of a jump they did in the polls. And I know it's early, the polls don't matter, but you know, everybody jumping on the bandwagon saying Texas is back, and said, well, you know, you saw them go out there and kind of mismanage the quarterback situation and throwing guys in and out, you know, in the third quarter and giving up a whole bunch of points to a not so great team and shooting themselves in the foot and then punting it in the fourth quarter. So yeah, it sure does look like Texas is back. You know, Texas in the last two or three years, but
never left.
Yeah, Texas never left. No, but there, I mean, there are very few coaches that I think if I had any eligibility left that I would play for, and Charlie Strong would definitely be one of them. I don't know if they've got. Please, Coach Patterson, you can't make me run. I don't have any more eligibility left, I promise. He seems like just a great guy and a high character individual and a guy who definitely cares about, you know, his kids outside of the lines when they're done playing football, what kind of guy that they are. And so I can definitely appreciate that and I respect that. But I don't know if they're getting the right kind of kids. You know, they get a lot of guys that are attracted to the Texas lifestyle, and if it, I obviously don't know. This is speaking from the outside looking in, but you know, from at least the last five, 6 years as a sample size, you know, nobody's been able to do less with more, and you know, with all their 4- and 5-star kids across the table, and you know, their top 20, 15, 10 recruiting classes, you know, just kind of not an excuse, because the kind of kids you have coming in are, you know, the best kids in Texas and some of the best kids across the United States. And, you know, it's weird to see that, you know, with a guy who wants to put that emphasis so much on defense that he just, you know, can't really get it done. But it is a long season. There's a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of football left to be played, and, you know, their big win against Notre Dame was looking less and less good, you know, as the season goes on. But I wouldn't be surprised if they throw another 5 or 6 wins up and that's it. That was tough to watch.
Well, that brings up a really good point too, when you talk about recruiting, and I want to circle back to TCU a little bit. You know, when Patterson talks about the lack of emotion and, you know, the lack of leadership, TCU's recruiting has ticked up quite a bit here the last couple of years. And you played with a couple of big name guys that chose TCU over bigger programs too, that, I mean, didn't last through their 4 years at TCU. Did those two things kind of go hand to hand? As you get these bigger names and these quote unquote bigger star guys, you see a little bit less emotion, and it's less about, you know, the team and the family, and more about, I got to get mine and make sure I'm preparing myself for the next stage of my career, just kind of using college football as a jumping off point.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple guys that would come through, and you know, they've been good athletes their whole lives, and they've you know, never really had to deal with, you know, somebody saying no or that they can't have something or do something, and they may or may not have been passed along simply because they were a great athlete. That doesn't mean that, you know, I wouldn't have fought somebody for them, you know, because they, you know, when they were in that locker room, they that was kind of the cool thing. And whether that was the case, if they were, you know, more focused on themselves, you know, they were at least, you know, good in the locker room. But yeah, and it's, I'm, by now it's been, you know, run into the dirt about, you know, the kind of guys that Coach P recruits, and just the guys who don't really have that shine on them, like a, you know, 4 or 5 star kid, the guy that hasn't been given everything simply because he's a great athlete. And that's kind of the cool thing when you look around and you see, you know, this 4-star cornerback commits to X college, or this 5-star here and there. And you look at their offer list, and it's all like the usual suspects. It's Alabama, Oklahoma, Texas, USC, blah, blah, blah. And it's like not all the time do you see an offer from TCU. And so that's kind of interesting to see, because they do such a great job of knowing the kid and figuring out if he's going to work. I mean, yeah, it'd be great to have a 5-star wide receiver, but if he's not able to gel with how Coach P runs his practice, then they don't want that there, because, you know, Coach P he's going to run that program the way he wants for as long as he wants to. And he's earned the right to do that. So if a kid isn't going to mesh with him and mesh with his assistant coaches and their coaching style, that 5-star ranking isn't going to do anything other than, you know, just add to preseason hype, which you can see really doesn't do anything for anybody when it comes down to brass tacks. But it's that's something, the coolest thing that I like to see when you see other kids committing and you look at their offer list and they are a 3, 4, 5-star kid, and, you know, just kind of look at them and say, oh, he didn't have an offer from TCU, and then just kind of follow them throughout their career and see if they have a, you know, get in trouble with, you know, the coaches or walking off the field because things got tough. And they just do such a great job of not getting just great athletes, but great people and kids who really want to work hard, and it's bigger than themselves, and they understand how to do their 111th and know that they're just a part, they're just a cog in the machine, just to be able to do their job well and to have a great time with their brothers in that locker room.
I think that's just great insight. And, you know, you start to see, like you said, some of these programs, like, I mean, probably more so A&M than Texas right now, and how quickly those locker rooms turn if things start to not go their way, because they're, you know, it's a little bit of the old inmates running the asylum kind of thing, a little more brass and flash than it is actual kind of nuts and bolts wanting to work through it. So love the insight into that TC recruiting process. And you were a pretty highly ranked guy coming out of high school. You were a 3-star recruit, I believe.
Yeah, I was trying to remember. I was like a 3. Yeah, I think I was a 3-star. Yeah,
I may have just, you know, Googled that to double check my information. So I'd say that pretty confidently. and you had, I am doing my research here. And you had some pretty big offers too. Did you kind of feel like you knew what you were getting into when you signed up to play for Gary Patterson?
Yeah, I really did. And I, you know, being from McKinney and this school being an hour away, and, you know, I had the opportunity to go visit a lot of schools, and, you know, I went to Purdue, I went to, where else did I go? I went to Mississippi State, I went to A&M, I did some of these other places, and it just didn't feel right. And then that first time that I got to step on campus in Fort Worth, and it just, I knew exactly that's where I wanted to spend my time. And, you know, for me, it was awesome because it's not so close to where, you know, my parents could just stop in and whatever, but if I needed to go home and do something, I could do that. You know, just 62 miles right up the road. So it wasn't a big deal, but, yeah, so it was really cool getting to go through that process. And I, after I committed, you know, I had, you know, 4 or 5 other programs come out and said, hey, if you decommit, we'll offer. And it was like, I can't remember who else. It was like Oklahoma State and a couple other, you know, bigger programs. Like, if you decommit, was like, we'll offer, but if you're not going to decommit, you know, we're not going to bother sending an offer. I was like, nah, man, I'm good where I'm at. You know, I really enjoyed it. I meshed with a lot of the guys in that recruiting class that I'm still, you know, close with to this day. I talk to every single day. And it was an awesome experience. And I definitely urge, you know, a lot of the kids, you know, I'll go back to my old high school and a couple
high schools where I have, you know, relationships with some of the head coaches and talk to some kids and let them know that it's like, man, you know, just because you get an offer from a big time school doesn't mean you can just commit without going down there and seeing what it's like to be on campus and be around the guys. And that was something that I got to experience. And, you know, my head coach, he had known Coach Patterson for a long time. He's like, hey, you know, I think you should go check out a practice before you commit. And so I went there and he was like, all right, you see how intense it is. You think you can handle it? I think you're ready to commit. So yeah, I did that. And yeah, it's obviously things worked out pretty okay.
Yeah, they definitely did. They definitely did, man. And we're all, I think, glad that you ended up in the purple and white, because you were such a great player along that offensive line for your time here. And, you know, I enjoyed watching you block the hell out of people and open up lanes for all those running backs and for all those guys. So
appreciate it.
Melissa, I know that in you put the rundown together for the show tonight, and you mentioned that you wanted to talk a little TCU volleyball because they had a huge upset that we definitely need to talk about, and you wanted to give a shout-out to soccer. I know pretty much as little as someone can know about those two sports generally. I did follow along with volleyball a little bit last year as they had a pretty good season. But will you fill the listeners in on just how important and how big this upset was for TCU volleyball over North Carolina, and just how great soccer has been so far this year?
Well, you know, we'll start with the soccer program here. TCU soccer is off to, I believe, the best start in their history. They have not lost a game. They're 7-0 with just a single tie here against some pretty top-name programs. They've already had a win against Maryland, a win against Illinois, Washington State, and some other, or Washington State's coming up here, or that was their tie, sorry, not their win, double overtime. But they've really started off strong, and they seem to put together a group that has some talent. They've got some scoring ability, but just a really, really solid defensive program. So once they get into the Big 12 season here, which will open up against Oklahoma in Norman on the 23rd of this month, we'll have obviously a little bit better idea of what their hopes nationally are. But this is a program that has been steadily improving over the last couple of years and has a real shot to maybe contend for a postseason berth, maybe an outside shot at a Big 12 title this year if they can find just a couple little missing pieces to just get the ball in the back of the net a couple more times a game. But I'm not a huge soccer knowledge person, but I know what TCU has done so far this season is really special. And TCU women's soccer is one of the biggest draws nationally for women's soccer at the collegiate level. So the fans have done an awesome job. Students are doing a great job packing that place out. A lot of times they have Friday home games before TCU football games next Saturday. So highly encourage everybody to get out there, check them out. They do really cool soccer scarves. So if it ever drops below 100 degrees, you can go get yourself a TCU women's soccer scarf and rep them. Volleyball I know a little bit more about. That's on my past history of coaching. And what Jill Kramer has done just with this TCU volleyball program is just unbelievable. Those of you guys don't know Jill Kramer's story, she was the first recruit that TCU volleyball signed. I believe she signed in 1996. And actually, I roomed with a volleyball player when I was at school there in the late 90s. And so I knew her as an undergrad, you know, saw her play when she was a student. And just a really neat person. Her career kind of took her all over the country as she kind of got into the coaching ranks. Was at West Virginia before Crystal Conti and TCU managed to get her to come back home. And her recruiting has been off the charts. It's unbelievable the type of talent that she's attracting. DFW is such a hotbed for women's volleyball. There's so much talent, you know, within 25 miles of TCU's campus. And she's really started to convince kids, you know, to come to TCU over Texas, over Oklahoma, over some of the bigger name programs in the Big 12. And those early results are paying big, big dividends. And so they took on North Carolina, which was a number four team in the country, and they beat them in five sets. So they'd already lost them once this season, and they came back and beat them on their home court. And maybe the most monumental, the biggest win in TCU volleyball history, if not, it's second to the Texas last season. So I think legitimately this team has a chance to contend for a Big 12 title this year. They were a postseason team a year ago, but they could be looking at, you know, maybe a Elite Eight, you know, possibly maybe a Sweet 16 berth this year. And volleyball is such a sport of momentum. If you get ahead in a couple sets or you get a team down on their heels a little bit, it's really easy to take over and knock off a higher ranked team. And You know, I think Coach Kramer has put together the talent to do so. Again, it's another place where the fans have just absolutely packed it. Soccer and volleyball season tickets are some of the best deals in at TCU season tickets, like $100 a piece. It's absolutely nothing. You get a ton of games, great environment. We all know the priority point system. That's a real easy way to pick up some extra priority points and to support another TCU program. And their new volleyball court and the new facility is just unbelievable. It's beautiful, great court. They did a great job on the paint job. I know we've posted about that quite a few times on Frogs War. So, family-friendly, take the kids. You could have a really cheap night of entertainment in Fort Worth and support two really, really great women's programs on this campus. Ahead of, you know, kind of in between those football games on Saturdays and before the basketball season gets rolling.
Yeah, that's awesome. And, you know, I guess what we should do then moving forward is because Jill Kramer played and then is now the coach of volleyball and Jamie Dixon played at TCU and now is the coach of the basketball team. So really when Jamie Dixon starts to succeed at his alma mater as the head coach because he's bringing in elite recruiting talent, we should call it the Jill Kramer effect, shouldn't we?
I think so. And you know, when Jeff Olson takes over for Gary Patterson here, you know, 10, 15 years down the line, we'll just keep that train rolling, huh? I could see you and Henson coming back together, running this thing.
I don't know. Y'all can't afford me.
Oh, wow.
If TCU can't afford you, then I don't even want to know what that looks like.
No,
all right. So
Henson, maybe. I'll stick to tailgating.
There you go. Well, hey, speaking of that, if you want to swing by mine or Melissa's tailgates in the future, you're obviously more than welcome. But we definitely should meet up at some point. So, you know, we always, Jeff, kind of end the show with a feel-good story or kind of like a funny story or just something from the college football landscape. So tonight I wanted to end with a story about North Dakota State, an FCS domination team, a powerhouse at the FCS level that is now 6-0 in their last six games against the FBS, including a win over Iowa 23-21 this past Saturday. So here's the list. They started playing FBS team, or I guess this list starts in 2010. In 2010, they beat Kansas 6-3. Kansas paid them $375,000 to play that game. In 2011, they beat Minnesota 37-24. Minnesota paid them $350,000 to play that game. In 2012, they beat Colorado State 22-7. Colorado State paid them $250,000 to play that game. In 2013, they played Kansas State and they won 24-21. Kansas State paid them $350,000 to play that game. In 2014, North Dakota State played Iowa State. They beat them 34-14. Iowa State paid them $350,000 to play that game. And in 2016, Iowa paid North Dakota State $500,000 to play that game on Saturday. And North Dakota State came in and beat them 23-21. That is $2.175 million that North Dakota State has been paid in the last six games against FBS schools, and they've won all six. How ridiculous is it? When are teams going to stop scheduling North Dakota State?
Apparently now, I would guess. I would think that would be the time. I mean, I thought I got a pretty good deal when we got paid $500 to when I was coaching NAIA basketball to lose to Sac State. So apparently we had some bad negotiations on our part, but man, paying to get embarrassed on your home field. I don't feel for it. If you schedule a Dakota school, you earn what you got. And everybody from Arkansas laughed at me when I said that South Dakota State wasn't a joke. Well, their cousins to the north weren't much different, were they?
No, they definitely weren't. They definitely weren't. And, you know, North Dakota State has two open slots in its 2017 schedule, and something tells me that they're not going to get filled by FBS schools.
Oh, I hope you enjoyed your run, North Dakota. You are never playing an FBS school again.
Until, that is, until they join the Big 12. So,
stop it.
They might be the best candidate out there for us right now.
Hey, tell me about it. So, y'all, we're wrapping up the show here.
thank you, Jeff, so much for coming on tonight. It was a blast to have you. We'd love to have you back anytime if you're willing. Melissa, it's always good. But for Melissa and Jeff, I am Tammy Plunkett. This has been the Frogs of War radio show. We'll see you all on Thursday night when Melissa and I preview SMU. Have a good night.
Beat the ponies.
All right. That was pretty good, huh?
That was awesome. You were awesome. Dude, you killed it.
Like, yeah, thanks, guys.
That was
thanks
really good. I loved
star.
Your insight into the recruiting. And you know, I think anytime people can kind of get – those of us that will never have the chance to experience that, it's always so interesting. And you had a great spin on that, great sense of humor about it. I think everybody's going to love that show.
Heck yeah.
Absolutely. I appreciate you guys having me on. I always love doing it.
Yeah,
oh, don't
well,
say
we
that because we'll bring
you
back.
Oh yeah, yeah. Henson made that same mistake. He said he'd come back anytime.
Yeah.
So we might have to get
you
both on the
awesome.
Horn at the same time.
We need to get a round table, a former players round table up here,
just
and just do like a special,
just
a 2-hour special for you know the bye week or something, and just let all of the former players just bring us inside the huddle, inside the locker room a little bit. I think that'd be awesome.
I was going to say, that may not be a good idea. We'll get off on some tangents and start talking about some bye week and off-season stories. And I don't know if you got enough FCC bleep buttons for that.
We'll put that. It'll be Frogs of War After Dark. You know, things can get ugly there.
I'll just rate it as PG-13 on Blog Talk Radio. It'll be fine. It's what I did for Henson last week. I was like, you know, we were DMing a little bit, and he was like, you know, I might not be able to contain myself. I said, that's fine. I'll just up the rating on Blog Talk Radio, and you can say whatever you want.
That's great. So do they have an invisible ink option in the Blog Talk Radio, or is that just an iPhone thing?
No, it's just an iPhone thing. Oh, man. But, yeah, Jeff, thanks so much for coming on, man. You were awesome. You always are, but you were awesome again, so we appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate it. Yeah. Anytime y'all need anybody else to fill in, let me know. I pay way too much attention to the Frogs game, so I can always pick up on something.
Oh, man, we love it. That's awesome. We'll take you up on that for sure.
All right. Y'all have a good one. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you too. Have a good one.
Y'all.
All right.
Take care. He was awesome.
Dude, all these former players are so great. Like, it's just such a different perspective because I feel like we know what we're talking about, but – you get those guys that have been on the field in those locker rooms. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. So we gotta maybe make this a Sunday night thing where we're just trying to book former players every Sunday night. Cause
hello.
Last two Sundays. Hey, are you there?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. What did you say? Sorry. After that. Yeah.
I was just saying, you know, maybe we make it a Sunday night thing where we're getting former players on. Cause they are. Henson and Olsen have both been just so awesome.
Oh, they've been fabulous. I really do think maybe either during the bye week or in the off season or, you know, somewhat time between the end of the season and the bowl game, doing a round table and getting 3 or 4 of those guys to come on and we could just sit back, ask questions and listen. That could be unbelievable.
Yes. Oh my gosh. It would be incredible.
Yeah. That'd be really cool.
It would be incredible. I mean, I think Henson would do it. I think Olsen would do it. I think Chris Gardner would do it.
Oh yeah.
Maybe if all those guys are doing it, Jaden would do it.
Yeah.
Get the kicker perspective in there.
Jeez, yeah. Yeah, that would be interesting. I'd love to hear them just rip the kicker, too, because you know they would.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that would be awesome. I think we need to put something like that together. It'd be good for the bowl season, too, and just kind of have them talk about, you know, what goes on during bowl week and what the prep is like for that, because that's when all the interesting stories tend to happen anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, all right. Well, on to the next thing.
Man.
Huh?
On to the next. Yeah, I'm going to start my NFL recap for week 2. I'll take care of that this one, so you don't have to write it.
Hey,
don't double write me homie.
Good communication. Yes.
That's what I'm here
for. I'll allow it. I'm going to get my Monday morning quarterback in tonight and then finish up my Big 12 is on fire panic.
Yeah. I'm going to work on that. Crystal Conte thing too. How much of a bitch can I be in that? Just like being honest, like, can I just put together a whole graphic? Like, is it hot? Should you tweet Crystal Conte about this, yes or no?
I think an infographic thing is the way to go. I definitely wouldn't
that's a good idea.
I definitely wouldn't post any
actual tweets of people tweeting at him.
I wanted to, but I couldn't do it. An infographic is a really good idea and make it kind of a funny thing.
Funny thing. We're here to help you decide whether or not you should tweet at Chris Del Conte and just kind of frame it that way.
That's a good idea.
Build an infographic.
I'll have you read over it too before it posts. I'll try to get that out. Since we don't have a home game this weekend, it might be a good thing to post on Saturday. Just as kind of a fun little, hopefully after we celebrate the SMU win.
Yeah, I think that's good. That's a good call.
All right, man. Have a good night. I'll holler at you later.
I'll talk to you later. All right, bye.
Bye.